Tim, thanks very much. It's a delight to be here and a delight to be amongst such a great panel. This is the third in the series that MJCC and CEDA have been hosting, the Young Leaders Series. For those of you who didn't attend the earlier ones, the first was about entrepreneurship and a panel of very talented people under the stewardship of James Talia explored the issue on entrepreneurship and what does it mean, where are opportunities emerging, and how certain kinds of people are pursuing those opportunities for their benefit and the benefit of others. The second in the series was considering the role of PR, advertising and marketing. And James Tuckerman led a group of other talented people to explore the issue, the synergies between those areas and the roles that they play in shaping the landscapes that we're seeing. Tonight, the question is, MBA or not to MBA? And based on the discussions I've had to date, it is a very, very topical area. So I'm looking forward to exploring this issue with our esteemed panel. Why don't we meet them? John Seibold, firstly, welcome. You are in the business of business education. Tell us a bit about you, about John Seibold, where you've been, where you are, and where the future lies for you.
Very good. Thank you, David. And I am in the business of business education, and I have been for quite a few years. And I'm delighted that you asked me to come talk about that tonight. Let me tell you a bit about what you would hear, or we here in Australia call our journey. That's a word that I really like it. And I hear it a lot here, but I'll tell you a bit about mine because it will give you some insight maybe into to MBA or not to MBA, wherever the discussion leads. I had not been in Australia at all until just about 2 years ago today when I came very secretly to interview with a selection committee for the job that I now have at the Melbourne Business School. That has been the capstone, I would say, up to this point, of a career that has been in management education since 1974, when I first went into a business school to be a professor after several years of doing other things before that. In the meantime, my field, by the way, other than deaning, is organizational behavior and leadership. And so I have been a professor of that for quite a few years. I've been a dean since 1987, and so some people say, my gosh, you couldn't do it, so you taught it, and then you couldn't teach it, so you administered it. Well, that's not quite what I'd like to say. Most of my career has been spent based in North America, focusing on issues in North America, in Europe, in South America, or Latin America, in Asia, in terms of issues, as I said, of organizational behavior leadership and how do you structure jobs so that they are exciting to people and so on, really focusing for the last 20 years or more on what do business schools do right, what do they do wrong, why do they do what they do, how do we design our MBA programs so that indeed they will engage our constituents, so that you don't ask that question to MBA or not to MBA. And I've worked with many business schools in various parts of the world, but never here. So how did I end up here? And that's the part that might be instructive. When I, as a dean, was looking for an MBA school, I looked for the same things that I think that people who are going to go into an MBA program look to, and that professors and look to when they're going to go to an MBA school, and that recruiters look to when they're going to hire MBA students. There were two or three things. One, I had heard of Melbourne Business School. I had never been here, but I had heard of it, and I knew that it was, arguably, now I know definitely, the number one MBA school in Australia.
He's not bad at selling, is he?
No. But my point is, from another part of the world, I knew the school. I knew it had an international reputation. Number two, I knew that the school had a lot of really strong academic partners. In other words, I knew that our students here could spend significant chunks of time at schools like London Business School, Columbia, UCLA, Hong Kong Science and Technology, whatever the school is, as a part of their program. I knew that we had all that international reach. I said, that's the kind of school that I am interested in being at. The next reason had to do with I had heard that Melbourne Business School had just merged with Mount Eliza Business School. Mount Eliza Business School, I had heard, was the preeminent provider of executive education in this country. I thought, now here are two schools that have seen the future of management education, taking a big, bold move to have the whole portfolio, if you will. Okay, I will stop, but that's my point of how I got here was because of the reputation of the place and the program and the students and the companies that came here. That's what led me to pick this school, which I argue is the same thing that students do when they pick the program they're going to go into.
Thanks,
John. I think I've talked too long already.
Just right. Okay. Thank you. Tinker Costillo-Wells. I love this line. Reoriented your career, in fact, your trajectory, into the human zoo that is the world of business and commerce. Tell us about Tinker.
Well, I started life off as a zoologist and had all the idealised notions that a zoology graduate back in the 1970s, late 60s would have, and was unable to realise most of them because they included things like counting the elephant herd in Kathmandu and languishing somewhere in the Galapagos Islands working out the nesting instincts of the booby bird or whatever. And it was very hard to get a job in those days as a girl working in field research because most of the field research teams were male and you would dissipate their important funds by having to establish a second toilet and all sorts of nonsense things like that. Anyway, I decided that economic independence was the way to go. It wasn't going to come through zoology, so I just moved to a bit further up, in fact, to the top of the evolutionary tree, and decided that I needed to make an income, I needed to see the world, which in those days when I lived in Perth was the East, and the only organisation I could actually beg in the end to employ me was Myer. And I got the job on the basis that I had a heavy science basis in my degree, and they needed somebody to convert the entire organisation from the old imperial system to the SI system of measurement. And I stayed there for the next 12 years. And they were great years. And I ended up doing quite senior things. And I had a frisson, just a little brush with what was going on the other side of the glass ceiling. And it is glass, and I therefore decided I don't like that. But how can I change what it is that I'm doing? How can I get out of this and become, for me anyway, to start a journey really that consisted of being less of a corporate person? I wanted to be in charge of my own destiny. I wanted to see a very much closer link between my effort and my remuneration. And basically, I needed an intellectual hit. I was sick of KPIs and all the other things, and the performance appraisals and the administration that goes along with the life that I had led with Maya. So, like a lot of people, I chose the MBA to actually make that kind of strategic rejig, if you like, in my career path. And it worked extremely well. The wellest part of it was that I finally became financially savvy, because up until then I had grown up in one major function. Yes, I had ended up heading it, but I still didn't know enough about every other function. And I think the financial savvy and the ability to just basically get out and do my own thing, which is what I ended up doing for the next umpteen years, very small group of my fellow MBA colleagues and I would get around our kitchen tables and we would do research for whoever was looking for something. Like, for example, we did some work in the finance sector over several years on diversity because it was a very hot topic. I also did research for the Melbourne Business School for many years, not all consecutive. I worked on their placement survey, which in fact was a very enlightening experience, because there's a lot of material that you don't see in the Financial Times ratings that are important to know about whether or not to do an MBA. I don't regret it for one minute. But I was still looking for the intellectual hit in all of this. I thought, surely a profession like this has got something in it to feed my brain. And that was when I resorted in the end to doing a doctorate, which I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed. It was just one giant intellectual journey. And I looked into a subject this wide to that depth. And I must say, because it was related to the financial field, has quite frankly assisted me in becoming even more independent in the things I choose to do. I don't like working for somebody else. I like to run my own show, and I can do that. When you're sufficiently financially savvy, you can do it. And I thank the MBA for that. Is that it? Oh, and I'm still trying to work out what I want to be when I grow up. I've had far too many jobs. I think I read more like a Gen Y than a post-war baby boomer, but 13 or 14 jobs isn't too bad, is it?
Yeah, I think that's a fair fist.
Well, you have a year to learn and a year to do it and then a year to leave it.
Love your philosophy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tinker. Like John and Tinker, Catherine isn't comfortable with an easy life. Let me see. Newly acquired mortgage, first child on the way, you decided to register a business name and then began research with an area that fascinated you, and then created the world's first all-natural and organic baby skincare brand. And may I add, in doing so, created the category of natural baby care products. Tell us about Catherine Arfi.
In your notes, you'll see that I left school in contrast to my fellow panellists at 15. But actually, I was working part-time at 12. And I actually have a 12-year-old son, so I can't imagine what that would have been like for my parents. But when I actually left school and I was working at 15, I held on to my part-time job. So I was working two jobs at 15. And I guess that's an example of the kind of drive and focus that I had. I remember having a little tiny leather purse that would burst at the seams, full of coins that I was saving for a particular item. And actually one of my prize items that I purchased was a typewriter. So I actually started my company 20 years later with that same purple typewriter that I saved up for at 10 years old. So I guess that gives you a bit of an idea of the kind of drive that I have. I always thought of myself as a reluctant businesswoman. I went through several career changes early on, but quickly found that I felt very comfortable and inspired by the fashion and beauty industry. I was sewing at 8 years old at home, making my own things. I was producing toy clowns and selling them and financing money from that to buy more and make more. So even back as a child, I was already trading, if you like, and making and saving and, looking to what I could do and what bigger things I could buy and how I could achieve what I needed to. I ended up having what I thought was a dream job in my 20s. I was there for about 4 or 5 years. Travelled the world, had a company car, had a great wage. At the time, I was single. And I actually had to be pushed into that job as well. It was a bit out of my comfort zone. I'd been there for some time in admin, and I remember the founder of the company saying to me, "What about if I give you a big fat pay increase and I give you a car and I send you overseas and you can go into sales?" And I said, "No, I don't want to go into sales. I don't like selling. I don't want to try and convince people to buy things from me. That's awful. I mean, if they say no, you feel rejected." And he said, no, look at it as in a product development role. So, and I'll give you all of these things. So I thought, okay. He said, if I didn't like that job, I could go back to my secretarial admin thing and I'd be fine. So obviously that was the start of me blossoming into my accessory and product development area that I ended up working in, and I still work in now. The company was actually closing down and I was retrenched. It was, I think, a week or so before Christmas, and I just had some news that I was expecting my first baby. was unexpected news. So I had recently acquired my own apartment, so I had a mortgage, the car went, I had this baby on the way, and thought, oh my God, like I'm absolutely just going to die here. And it took me sort of a day of hyperventilating and crying and whatever, thinking, what am I going to do to turn this around? And I ended up just sort of picked myself up and I thought, I'm going to register a business name and I'm going to focus on something that will give me a goal, because I'm quite goal-driven and I knew as a child, you know, what sort of things got me through. And that's what I did. So registered that name, did a lot of research. I was sort of out the door, you know, straight away from that business. And a lot of people said, oh, it was easy. You had the contacts. You were already dealing with, you know, those companies or whatever. Actually, it's quite the opposite is true. So if you're in an area where you're developing accessories and fashion items, as you will know, Tinker, like within organisations like Myer, buyers change all the time, and also different departments are run quite separately and independently. So you have to build your own network of contacts and you have to really start from scratch. And whilst I was building my contacts and my networks, I was also developing and researching this range that I wanted to launch. I had quite a keen interest in natural therapies and holistic care and that kind of thing, and was concerned about what to use on my baby. And having a look at the market and realising there was actually no natural baby care, I thought if I sort of did this twofold and reduced the risk, went to health professionals, so I went into the hospital sector and into retail, perhaps I would be sort of spreading myself a little bit thin and not having such a huge financial burden with more ways to get into the market, into retail and that kind of thing. So that's basically what I did. That was 12 years ago. We now have several brands that are exported all around the world. It's all Australian made. We sell to hospitals, we sell to the Hyatt and Western Hotels for corporate, and we deal with department stores and baby stores and pharmacy and that kind of thing as well. So, and that's where I am today.
I told you they were good.
I think we'll start out by finding out what an MBA actually is. Before deciding whether it's worth doing, let's define what an MBA actually is, you know, what it represents to various people. I'll actually start by asking you, Catherine, what is an MBA?
I have no idea. When I was at school and when I actually left school, obviously an MBA wasn't even heard of for me. I went to a public school. I grew up in a very simple middle class family. Nobody went to uni. We didn't even go to kinder in those days. So for me to leave school and go straight into the workforce was just the way it was done. And certainly there was no precedent set in my circle of family or friends. So to go on to uni or to go on to do a degree or an MBA or anything else was simply out of the question. And for me, the sort of person that I was, I just wanted to get into the workforce, as is obvious. So in hindsight, I wonder, had I had different qualifications and had I had more structure,
right.
May I have fast-tracked my business? May I have been more organised or more structured, or would it have had an impact? It's hard to know, but that's sort of how it sits for me.
Okay.
Mm.
No idea what an MBA is.
Mm.
Tinker, what is an MBA?
At the time that I started my MBA, I was in charge of what in those days was called executive development for the Myer Group of Companies, and my job involved making calls on and knowing a lot about the various providers of executive education. And then lo and behold, we actually branched out even further and we looked at longer programs like MBAs. And it started to interest me because it looked like something that was some kind of credentialing device to start with. That's the obvious implication of having one. But secondly, it was when I looked at what I was doing and it was functionally focused and not very broad, there was plenty of depth in one function but no breadth. I could see from the subject matter that I would get that breadth and I would hopefully become, for me it was to become financially savvy, macroeconomically savvy, all the things that represented a hell of a lot more breadth than I had worked in. And that it was almost, it was an escape mechanism really.
Yeah.
It was very important that I did have the experience that I did, though, because it enabled me to find the best MBA, which was obviously University of Melbourne, Melbourne Business School. And we had already been sending a lot of people there for executive education programs, and the quality was there. So for me, yes, it was... I think it was all the things that... It didn't disappoint me, because I had such limited knowledge of all of the broader areas that I hadn't wasn't working in. It did disappoint me slightly in the sense that I kept waiting for the intellectual hit out of it all. It felt like I was doing every subject at the 101 level, which is understandable because you're trying to cover 21 subjects. In those days, we did it in 2 years. And I might add, in those days, it was free. It was a huge opportunity cost because you couldn't work for that time. But unlike you guys going in today, we had an incredible benefit. You made your decision on it was an easier decision to make, quite frankly. Mm. I think that's all.
Okay. Let's talk nuts and bolts. John, how would you define an MBA? What subjects are covered? How long does it take? How does one apply? What is the general process here? Mm. Let's get behind the face of it and understand the elements of it.
Well, first of all, there are MBAs and there are MBAs and there are MBAs, just like there are schools and there are schools and there are schools. So there is no such thing as the MBA, one could argue, relative to that. Having said that, there are commonalities across probably all MBA programs, regardless of if they're full-time, which can mean anything from 12 months full-time at some schools to 2 years full-time at other schools or somewhere in between, or part-time, which can be anywhere from 2 or 3 years part-time to 5 or 6 years part-time, or executive MBA programs, which can be anywhere from 14 months to 2 years, very intense periods of times. So across that, though, an MBA is, one, you gotta know the techniques. And so it's those functional technical skills that you just got to know about, that Tinka was alluding to, that she didn't know anything about accounting, she didn't know anything about finance, she didn't know anything about marketing, she didn't know anything about that general thing called management. And so it's got to have a core. Okay. Every program has a core. Every core is different in every program, but the core is designed to get people up to speed technically, functionally. Then the fun begins, if it's fun.
Oh, it was fun.
It is, Catherine. Trust us, it's fun. Then the fun begins, because that's what an MBA really is. An MBA really is, if it's doing it right, is it's about pulling it all together and its integration, and it's what I will call critical thinking. And so what an MBA is designed to do is just the opposite of what you knew you needed to do at some point also, which is go deep. It is, I now know the functions. Now I got to figure out how I can make, ultimately, quick decisions about things and really pull together across all these disciplines and across all these functions. And so when an MBA is doing it right, it is helping a person figure out how to integrate and how to be that critical thinker. It is not a specialist degree. That is not to say that within a lot of MBA programs you don't have a specialty of some kind. Mm. But the fact of the matter is that it's not designed to make you that in-depth specialist in anything other than leading organizations.
Mm. Based on your experiences, could you describe for us the profiles of people who, in fact, seek an MBA education and enroll in the program? What kinds of people are lining up to do an MBA?
Do you want me to talk about that, too?
I'm looking at you, Tinka.
I don't want to speak from personal experience because I'm probably not a good example. But if I look at the placement surveys that I have done, there are several kind of quintessential MBA candidates. There are the younger, as young as some times, 23, 24, often an engineering graduate. They could be in any many other disciplines. Engineering just happens to be one of the favourites. The sciences, even medicine, I've seen MBBSs come through. They have very limited management experience. They're doing it basically to change. About a third, just over a third, according to these surveys anyway, of the incoming group actually do the MBA to change their discipline. The engineers want to become management consultants. The MBBSs want to go into financial services. Those two industry sectors happen to be the two most popular. You then get the slightly older person, the late 20s, early 30s. That is really starting to get older. They tend to have, and they tend to be more the part, I mean, not from my point of view, because they're just babies, but, from an MBA point of view, given that you can get the 24-year-old engineers doing it, you'll get somebody who's in their late 20s, early 30s with a lot more management savvy behind them. Typically, they're functionally deep and don't have the breadth. And this breadth that that John is referring to, and that need to pull everything together and to have the specific skills to do that, is really very important. When some of the research I did back in the mid-90s was on the Carpen report, and the main criticism that Carpen study had of Australian management was that where we were good, we were great, but there were so few of us. The rest of us, there was this huge long trail of mediocrity following the few that were good. And the biggest problem that this trail of mediocrity had was good technical skills, great depth in one function, but inadequate breadth. Not enough in strategy, not enough in leadership skills, not enough in all the things that you need when you do an MBA, pulling things together. So I imagine there are people in their, not imagine, I know they're in their late 20s, early 30s, doing precisely that, actually wanting to make that next move to general management, for which you need to be able to pull those functions together. You do occasionally get the overqualified degree collecting person who does an MBA, but the selection process typically gets rid of that. Well, it's not just another degree. I mean, you need to do it. You do your MBA for very specific reasons. You have to. It's going to cost you, what, $45,000? $47,000, $48,000, $50,000? It's going to cost you $50,000 after tax. And that's another important point to note. A lot of the students are part-timers, and when I looked at the placement surveys of the part-timers, you might find this almost unbelievable, but nearly two-thirds of the group of part-time students had financial assistance from their employers. You've got to manage upwards and get your employer to pick up the tab, basically, because corporate Australia has a responsibility to make sure that that Carpen recommendation of growing breadth comes about, and the MBA is one bloody good way to do it. Mm. Now, of that nearly two-thirds, something like 50% of that group had their fees paid to the tune of somewhere between 100% and 50%, and they were typically paid on completion of each subject. So there are opportunities out there to get the employers on deck. Sorry.
Interesting statistics there. Catherine, you see a lot of people achieving some pretty significant things, and like you, they've not done an MBA. Tell us about the profile of those people.
Okay.
What are you seeing out there?
I think that they're people that have been pretty hands-on. Mm. So you're looking at people who are doers, and I guess they are goal-driven and they are focused. Probably a wide range of skills, which was something that Tinker was talking to, that they have to know a little bit about managing people, and they need to know a little bit about marketing and sales, and they need to know a little bit about planning. Even though I left school at that age, you find a lot of people like myself actually go back to do some further study later on. But you need to then decide what's the most important thing for my business and where I'm at. And for me, it wasn't having a degree at that point. it was getting credibility from the people that I was working with. So if I was working with hospitals and health professionals and I was working with new parents who were deciding what to use on their baby's skin, I needed to have some credentials that they could relate to, that they felt secure and that they could trust in the products that I was providing. So I chose to do more tactile studies. I did a diploma in aromatherapy and then I studied infant massage instruction. So they're quite different. It's a different part of what I felt was important. But certainly of the people that I see, and I do work with a lot of women in business, most of them have some degrees and or several, and I find that I'm more the creative marketing side. They're my strengths. I do a lot of journalism and writing for magazines and presenting and that side of it, whereas they're better on the people skills and the management and the structure. So, you know, we each bounce things off each other now. Mm.
We see a group of people emerge from the MBA program. Now, we commented before about what an MBA is. We were given a view, a couple of viewpoints, on the kinds of people who are applying to the program. What do we see emerge from these programs? What kinds of people are coming out of these MBAs? John?
A very diverse group.
Okay.
It's the same people who came in, by the way. I mean, as you mentioned, it used to be that a big bulk of students that would go into an MBA program were people like engineers. Now we're finding that it's a lot different in that there still are the engineers, but they're the people that are coming from all different kinds of majors, all different kinds of jobs, but who do have the one thing in common that you just said, Catherine, and that is that they see the next phase of their career being more managerial, whatever that means. And they have this sense that they don't quite know how to do it. So how are they when they come out? Well, some of them come out, as you said, and they go to consulting firms. Some of them go out and they go to financial services. Some of them come out and start their own businesses. Some of them come out and work for government. So who are they when they come out? A very, very diverse kind of group. Now, overlaid with that now, here, is the fact that how many are now coming out of programs like ours are from all over the world. And so they aren't what I would call or you would call the, quote, typical Australian, whatever that is. There is no such thing as a typical Australian. But they're from all over the place, and they're going all over the place. And so it is a new era of diversity, culturally, geographically, over the last 10 years, that's become very the common thread has been that as they come out, they are really a diverse group. Mm. Now, what does that say to me? That, again, the MBA is different things for different people. Mm-hmm. With that common thread of helping me try to integrate the various facets of my professional life.
Mm. Tinka, during your program, you would have been in contact with many people just like you that are doing this program. And I would assume that you've maintained contact with those people or people just like them. What's your impression in terms of the kinds of people that are developed here as a result of the MBA program? What kinds of people are emerging, particularly in light of your views on the kinds of people going in?
Gosh. In terms of who goes in and who comes out, I'm restricted to my particular cohort, and all I can really say about that group is that it's a great network and we still see a lot of each other, and a healthy proportion of the group has done exceptionally well in business. They've achieved great professional heights. There's a good solid group that went out and set up their own startups. Back in the mid to late 80s, it was actually considered a good thing to do as a result of your MBA to go out and set up a startup. Lately, I see the percentages getting smaller and smaller. It's probably just a difficult environment. But the people coming out, from my perspective, have demonstrated far more portability, if you like, than I ever expected. Mm. And we've often spoken about it, and it was the kind of thing that really the MBA gave them. I know it certainly gave that to me, because I did not want to go into corporate life. I wanted to be able to go wherever I wanted, quite frankly. And a lot of people actually did do a lot more moving and were able to, because they had this degree that basically helped them pull together a whole bunch of bits of information so they could go out and set up a startup, or they could go out and run the family business or run the family the pension fund or whatever it was that they were doing just for a small concern. They were all pretty goal-driven, but the goals varied considerably. And I suppose the thing I did notice also about the output of my group was that, unlike a lot of post-war baby boomers, there was a genuine desire to balance, to get some kind of balance in their lives, and that they actually wanted to work to live, is the cliche that we use for the Gen Ys these days, isn't it? Not live to work. Well, Gen Y didn't invent that. My cohort did. In terms of now what's coming out, what can I say? You see a bunch of very bright, ambitious, extremely capable people. The mechanisms for the new entry requirements for MBAs these days are a lot more stringent. It's very expensive, so that in itself is a selecting device. But the diversity is what's really impressive. You do get this. You used to get a lot of clumping. You're quite right with the engineers and the sciences and the health sciences and so on. Whereas now you get this incredible range, and you get an incredible range going out. You will see an MBBS going into financial services, and because I think now something like 60% of this year's student intake is international, isn't it? It's a 67, some incredible number. So you see going out an incredible array of extremely people with extremely high expectations about what they're going to do. I suppose that would be the consensus point I make about who I see, what I think about the groups coming out now. The thing I notice most of all are their incredibly high expectations for what they want and need the degree to achieve. And I think some of that's tied to the fact that it just costs so damn much to do it. Mm. And they're looking for... they're practising their MBA financial savvies. They're looking for returns and value-addeds everywhere.
Tinker, you raised the point about these people having high expectations. They're dynamic. They're capable. They're achievers. You strike me as somebody just like that, and I would assume, Catherine, that you're associated and connected with and are in contact with people just like that who have not necessarily undertaken this program. Is that true? And what's your impression of those kinds of people? What do they do?
Absolutely. I think that definitely I'm in circles where I'm networking with people that are doing similar things to me, and they are all entrepreneurial and they do have lots of different skills. I think that we're all quite different within the group that I associate with. Mm. And there will certainly be, as there would be with the MBAs and the other things that are going on, different strengths. So there are a group of us that would tend to be more on the creative side, and there's another group that tend to be more on the practical side. And we tend to bounce ideas off each other. I'm often asked for my input on the fashion and design and the marketing side. Mm. I'm quite good with PR. We do a lot of stuff in-house. Mm. Whereas the other people that I'm working with and friends and colleagues might have strengths that are in more of the logistics or some other aspect that we're not quite up to speed with. So we're really, I guess, trying to spend time sharing and supporting each other, mentoring each other. Mm.
Can you comment, Catherine, about the worlds colliding, bringing it together? People just like you and people that you associate with, working with and coming together, people who are really capable MBA graduates. Do you employ MBAs? Do you work with MBAs?
We actually don't. We're still quite a small business. We've only got 5 on our team, so the structure is quite small, and we do a lot of things for such a small team. A lot of that I find I'm bogged down doing, and perhaps, you know, for us to get to the next stage, I need to be looking at bringing in some expertise such as that, so that I can actually take a step back and concentrate on the areas that are my strengths, and they clearly are. I mean, I've been doing it for so long and I'm so good at that part of the business, and being able to identify the weaknesses that we have and bringing in people who are qualified and who can identify problem areas and put some structure in place so that we can move to the next level. So whilst we don't have anyone on staff on that level, we're certainly at that stage where we need to be looking at bringing in some expertise of that kind.
It's obvious from that comment that you'd be well served by engaging a management consulting practice that has MBAs. John, you would know literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are achieving great things, and you would see people who have MBAs and people who do not have MBAs working constructively together. Can you comment on that?
Sure. First of all, I'm going to go back to what Tinka said. This is unrelated to your question, but just you said something like 60-some percent of the people coming out of, let's say, our MBA program or coming in are from outside Australia. It's actually over 70% in the full-time program, which is just, I think, stunning. I say that in a positive way. It's really stunning. But that's not related to what your question is. Yeah. The MBA student, graduate, does not have any corner on the market for being really talented. But the teams that are really talented, who have a mix of some MBA talent, some in-depth talent, is kind of that blend of the relevance and the depth of the disciplines with enough of the MBA kind of person. Notice I didn't say an MBA, but the MBA kind of person who can help pull it all together. I see that a lot. You say, I've seen hundreds and thousands, and yeah, I got my MBA in 1971. All right, I started teaching MBAs, you know, sometime later. I've seen hundreds and thousands. And I've seen lots of these groups that have some MBAs, some no degrees, some very specialized degrees. And what's the key? Well, figuring out how you can develop that synergy. And I would argue that if we've done our job right with the Tinkas and the Davids of the world who got their MBAs, and that's okay, we'll get you in an executive MBA one of these days, as a total just life-changing event, that's what we'll do. But if we've got the right of you two as what I'll call the pot stirrers, that's where the real creativity and synergy comes to pass. But the MBA doesn't guarantee that at all. It does not guarantee that at all, just as if you get a JD, it does not guarantee that you are going to be the most fantastic lawyer in the world. Or if you get a PhD in finance, that you are going to be the greatest financial analyst in the world. But it does give you tools. It does give you roadmaps.
Tinka, you would have a view on that. You would have a view on these interactions between MBAs and non-MBAs, right? What did you see specifically?
Well, first of all, John's right. You don't have, the MBAs haven't cornered the market on anything, really. It's just one of many opportunities. What do I see? I'm in awe of people like Catherine who set up their own business, who really go out there and break the hard stuff and do it all on their own with her team of 5 eventually. But and I always look in these placement surveys, I always look at the figure for who, because we do track who goes out and sets up their own, actually sets up a startup, does it themselves, got the balls to get out there and do it. The percentage has always been very low, and the highest it ever got was something like about 10 or 11% of the group of the full-time MBAs actually went out and set up startups. And we have got some famous names. I just can't remember any of them at the moment. But it is a very small number. And I always feel very gratified when I see the percentage increasing, because I think that's really one of the key things that you want to do when you're doing the MBA. The MBA, it's a fabulous experience if you can possibly get into it. It's not just about getting ready in terms of the succession plans in your organisation to get to the next level of general management that you want to. It's about generally educating yourself. It's actually a good thing to be macroeconomically savvy. It helps put a whole lot of things in your life in place. For all sorts of other careers, it doesn't have to necessarily be a corporate career per se. You can be engaged in a whole lot of other professions, because the general management principles apply to hospitals, art directories, art galleries, museums, you name it. But I like the mix of MBAs and non-MBAs together. Hopefully we will fire off each other.
Mm. To their credit, CEDA and MJCC have put on this Young Leaders series to give some guidance and some directions and some signposts to future leaders. Where are the shifts here? Are we seeing a difference in the MBA program to suit the expectations that are changing? What are we seeing out in the real world in terms of different expectations of younger people? Let's take them in turn. Are the MBA programs shifting over time to cater for different expectations, apart from the fees going up, of course?
I'm assuming the two rise together. Are you asking me to answer that?
John, please.
Okay.
Oh, good, because
sure.
I can't answer that.
Programs are changing dramatically in terms of what I'll call the content and the context.
Okay.
Because back to what you said, Tinka, it's the experience. It is the experience that I have to tell you, and this will sound, I don't know how, it might sound disingenuous, but it's really true. I can't tell you the number of alumni from the programs that I'm now associated with who tell me the experience changed my life. It was a life-changing experience. When I first heard that, by the way, at the school where I was before I was here, I believed it, because that was a very, very different kind of business school. And so I thought, yep, that did change their life. Then I heard it here, and I thought, this can't be true. But I realized that indeed it is a life-changing, it can be a life-changing experience, right? Having said that, programs are changing dramatically, because of differing expectations of those coming in, Gen Y, X different than Gen Y, different than baby boomers, indeed. Whoops. So those different expectations, but there are also different expectations of those who will ultimately be employing or re-employing. Very different kinds of expectations. Even more importantly, very different expectations of society more broadly. I can't tell you how many times now, when I see people coming in or see companies, let's say, coming out, they ask questions about issues of corporate social responsibility, about the environment, about global warming. I mean, go down now the list of issues that are really critical to us as a society, and business schools are being asked to, within that life-changing environment, hopefully, create experiences that will help people deal with those issues. And that is relatively uncommon up until about 10 years ago, and then up until about 5 years ago, really. So the curricula have been changing to try to respond to these needs. Now, having said that, we all know that over the last several years, all these questions, I mean, even the question that we're asking, to MBA or not to MBA, you wouldn't have asked that question a decade ago. Nobody would have come. But around 5 or so years ago, people started saying, now, wait a minute, what is the value of that experience? And that started, of course, schools like mine to even rethink one more time, now, what is the value that we're adding? Again, I keep coming back to the theme of critical thinking, but even broadening that definition of what critical thinking is. And it's changed a lot. You look at our curriculum, you look at a curriculum of, I would argue, probably virtually every business school that you look at in their MBA programs, and 10 years ago it was very, very different than it is today. Much more disciplinarily bound 10 years ago. Today, the more creative ones have done away with their departments if they can, for example. We're lucky we didn't ever have departments, so we don't have to do away with departments. But again, to get people to talk to each other across intellect and across disciplines. That wasn't happening 10 years ago.
Okay. Catherine, your experiences here, future leaders, different trends, different patterns. I mean, you've started this essentially fairly young, and you've had a very rich experience. What's your view of people who are emerging as future leaders? What are they doing to make their mark in the world?
I think that what John was saying about changing the way that they're structured, their courses and that kind of thing is really important, because certainly for me 12 years ago, I was looking at what sort of impact I was going to have on the environment. I was looking at what sort of social issues were important. I was looking at the business on a global level and not just looking at a short-term, quick success. And for me, it was important to be successful domestically, I guess, and having as much of the product manufactured locally and that kind of thing. So I suppose, you know, as things progress, that it will become increasingly important to take in some of those factors and actually apply them to whatever you're doing, whether it's within a business or within, you know, your degree or your MBA and where you choose to undertake that study.
Mm. Okay. Well, we've had some interesting responses to the questions. I think it's time to invite members of our audience to pose questions themselves. We have about 10 to 15 minutes to spend asking questions. Can I invite people who would like to ask a question to stand to the microphone, please? Kindly tell us who you are and where you're from, and please direct your question to a member of our panel. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Maria Jockel from Maddox Lawyers. John, I found your comments very interesting in the context of the globalisation of education, and obviously your experiences are in that context. You were saying that the MBA is a fairly generic sort of postgraduate qualification. I don't mean to downrate it in using the word generic. There's been a bit of media coverage in regard to industry-specific MBAs where people have a career aspiration to become much better in a particular industry sector. I'm wondering whether you can comment on how does that sit with the Melbourne Business School?
Yeah.
And how you see that in a broader context, because what I see in the 21st century is that we're going to be perpetual students. The nature of technological change and career opportunities is so fast accelerating that we're not likely to stay in the same industry for 40 years, whatever our working life is. So we're going to become constantly, I would imagine, over 10 years or so, re-educate ourselves because certain career paths are going to go. So in that context, these very industry-specific MBAs, where do they fit in all of this?
Well, I worry about the industry-specific MBAs for the reason I think that you're alluding to, and that is that an industry-specific MBA sets a certain mindset, which is that industry. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but the fact is it is a much more global workplace, and if we target too much one industry, we don't get, I would argue, the breadth of creativity that if we have people from different industries sitting together in the room. So I would argue that the industry-specific MBAs will be short-lived. They're meeting a short-term need, which is we need to make sure that we as the industry, whatever, are doing what we need to do to survive and thrive as an industry. But I think what will happen within the next, I would argue, relatively few years is that the industry-specific MBA, the industry-specific MBA, will not be as popular as. And you use the word generic, and sure, we can say, well, that's maybe that's not the right word, but it's the right point is the creativity that comes across sectors is very different than it is within one sector. Tinka mentioned, arts. You mentioned not-for-profits. You would mention engineering firms. You get the engineering industry representative sitting with the director of a theater company. They're both going to learn an awful lot that an industry-specific program just won't give them.
I have two questions, one to Tinka.
Nick
Varagos, Managing Director of Opius. We do executive search, organisation design, board governance type work. Two questions, Tinka. First one to you is, you said the environment isn't such that is conducive, and maybe not your exact words, but conducive to entrepreneurial people coming out of your business school and becoming leaders. On the one hand, though, we have more private equity flush within the marketplace trying to find a home, and yet your sentiment is that the market's not supporting the entrepreneurial push. And maybe I can move the second piece into the first is, within the MBA, how much is devoted on leadership? And are we really looking to create leaders of the future? Because I think a lot of people come to an MBA as a path towards leadership for future performance.
I blamed the market or some vague thing out there for the small number of people going into their startups, albeit the availability of private equity, etc. I think I've chosen not to blame the program and not to blame the individuals going out. There must be something out there that makes it harder. And Catherine's a witness to that fact. It's bloody hard work. It's much easier, quite frankly, to go and work in a safe corporate environment where the structures are there, your succession plan's there, your career path is planned out, your remuneration is reasonably well linked to your output. It's low risk, and I think a lot of people look for the low risk alternative, and that's why only 10 to 11% of the group go out and basically lay their souls on the line and do it the hard way. And in fact, a lot of them succeed. It's an area that has a high failure rate, and that's likely to put people off. Now, what was the second part of your question? Oh, leadership. Is there any leadership taught in the MBA? Well, when I did the MBA, we didn't have this fantastic new subject that I hear a lot of my colleagues talk about, which basically looks at the world of management, which focuses far more on that whole concept, I think, of actually trying to integrate the functions and developing true leadership skills. But, God, I don't think leaders are made in an MBA program or any program for that matter or necessarily in any particular industry. There are too many special coalescing factors, if you like, that have to go into a person to make them the best leader. And I don't know the answer to it. If anybody does, and this is in spite of thousands and thousands of articles and huge amounts of research, you'll find a different point of view in every piece of work and every person in this room as to what makes a good leader. I think what the MBA did for me, for our group, was it turned us into bloody good general managers. We knew how to pull together and understood how you pulled together all of the functions within an organisation. So if we chose to do that, to go the safe corporate route, we would have been better equipped. And then out of that experience would have come, as it did, I'm sure, in many organisations, the leaders emerge. Leadership's not about managing. Leadership is something else, as I'm sure you understand. And I don't think it's something that you can be taught in an MBA in 2 years, or even, 16 months now. The syndicate work that you do in an MBA is absolutely magnificent. If you're going to find leaders or leadership skills or good organisational skills developing, they'll start there, and you can often pick. We all know in each syndicate you can tell who the chief organiser is going to be and whether they'll get out there and make their mark on the world. But that's probably the closest that my MBA experience led to developing leadership skills, apart from the obvious academic input. We could recite all kinds of theories and pieces of research, but I think the syndicate work is probably what helped us the most.
Hello, Joanne Gray from the Financial Review. John, I have a question for you about the EMBA. And I guess my question is really just for someone who's been in the workforce for 20 years or so and who's already achieved a lot, who's probably already quite a good general manager, what does the EMBA actually give them? What does it help them with?
Yeah. And the EMBA, and I'll just speak about, you know, from who I have seen in our EMBA here. And ours is a very interesting one in that the person comes, and the average age is probably 40 or so, and as you're saying, the average stage of their career is quite high. They're already in the high managerial executive ranks. And they come into our program, and our program is a program where they live together, they eat together, they breathe together, they syndicate together, for 1 month at a time. They live in the school, and then they go away for a few months and go back to their lives, and then they come back for another month intensely, and then they go back to their lives. Then they come back for another month. Well, they do it four times, and that's the program. The reason I'm dwelling on that is that it is a really intense intellectual and networking and bonding experience. And that's what it's designed to be. Okay, so what do they get out of it? They get an unbelievable network. They know their classmates better than, frankly, in many ways, you got to know yours in that full-time program back then because it's so intense. They get to think about the things they've been doing for the last 15 years in just a very different kind of way. A very different kind of way. Because they're all having similar kinds of experiences in that they're at the same kind of level, very different kind of industries, but they see their world so very differently that senior partner at PwC, for example, is so different than that medical director at Royal Children's Hospital, and there they are, living together, trying to figure out how do you deal with these issues, coming from very different kinds of viewpoints. So what do they get out of it? They don't get out of it the next job, because they're already there, many of them. But what they do get out of it is a real different sense of, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? What am I going to do with the rest of my career? And what am I going to learn from these people that are a very talented bunch of people that I now have worked with and lived with in such an intense way?
Hi, I'm Jaspal Sarai, sales manager at Optus. Question for Catherine. I guess in terms of entrepreneurs who are non-MBAs, as David was sort of alluding to, I've listen to a lot of people who've made success out of that part of life. And one thing I have picked up consistently is that there has to be a crisis, a job loss or something or the other to turn them into entrepreneurs. Is that something you find consistent in your circle? And second part of the question is, with the low number of MBAs going into entrepreneurship, is it overanalyzing or their risk-taking ability to get out there, or is it more opportunities that perhaps they are creating for themselves and they're not willing to jump?
Certainly within my group of colleagues and people that I work with, there's both. There are the ones that had the crisis and nothing really quite like mine. Mine's probably quite a dramatic event. It was quite a dramatic change for me. There was quite a lot of things that happened and it was quite life-changing. But certainly there are some planned business entry and there are some of the ones that are a result of a crisis, but not quite, as I said, to the degree of my own experience. I think that there is, you know, there is a lot of opportunity within the corporate world, and perhaps it is a lower risk option with or without, you know, the MBA to actually enter the corporate world and work your way up the corporate ladder. Certainly, you know, there are a lot of benefits that far outweigh doing it my way. And one of those is obviously financial benefit. You know, you have to work a long time and build your brand or your service or your business to a level where it's very credible and very acceptable in the marketplace, and usually outside of Australia as well. So it has to be globally, because we're so niche here. And that's even more so if you have a very niche product or service, that you need to become a success here and then quite quickly need to look offshore if it's going to be long term and, you know, you want to build a viable concern. I guess, you know, the risk factor could be, you know, one of those issues. But then, you know, looking at my point of view as well, I've got fabulous other benefits and flexibility, and I can work around my young family. I can build my business trips into, you know, tag a holiday on the end, etc. So, I mean, I've got other things that I can use to my advantage. I've got a lifestyle. So some of the things that I have, you know, I have, you know, had some bigger financial risk, but I think that I've also, at the other end of the scale, got some, you know, fabulous positives out of it as well.
MBA or not to MBA? That's the question, and it's been a delight to have this conversation, and clearly there isn't one answer. There are many answers, and it depends on your frames of reference about what you conclude the MBA to be and its value to you and your growth and development.